Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Media mogul Rupert Murdoch, the man behind Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and much more, is preparing for battle again, says my guest today. After a controversial lifetime of taking on the powers that be, he's now lined up to take on the New York Times. It's just one paper, but it stands for a kind of journalism, a perspective on the world, maybe an agenda that Rupert Murdoch just doesn't buy. He's got his own Think Fox. This hour, On Point, Rupert Murdoch versus the New York Times, and who will set the nation's news agenda? You can join the conversation. Do the moguls matter anymore with the web swallowing the news business? And what if the man who owns Fox topples the New York Times? What are the stakes here? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Gabriel Sherman. He's contributing editor at New York Magazine and author of the current cover story, Murdoch's Endgame. Gabe Sherman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
The raging septuagenarian is your headline inside the magazine. He turns 79, a week from tomorrow, but you note, we note, his mom is 101 and going strong. Who knows how many years he's got? What is Rupert Murdoch up to here?
Well, that's a great question, and to sort of start it off, what my piece looks at is the fact that Rupert is turning 79, and there was this whole notion when he bought the Wall Street Journal 2 years ago in 2007 that he would have, you know, sort of moved into the retirement phase of his career, and his obsession with the Journal would be his preoccupation. But what we've seen is actually quite the opposite has happened, and he's so active on so many different fronts. He's showing no sign of slowing down, and he's really trying to, you know, sort of transform and remake the media landscape as he sees fit.
You write in here about how he's going after Google. We've talked about that very recently, Murdoch versus Google, for a full and very fiery hour, I must say. You also look at his family and succession. We'll talk about that with you today. But this attack on the Times is maybe most interesting. Before we even go to it, though, give us a sense. Remind us of the News Corporation empire here, kind of its scale and reach, Gabe.
Well, what News Corp really is, to back up for a second, to understand News Corp, you have to first understand the fact that it's not a traditional company. While it is traded on the stock exchange and it is a public company with a board of directors, it really is the creation and the vision of Rupert Murdoch. And he really runs the entire company as he wants to. And there's not a lot of committees, bureaucracy. You know, it's funny, there's a quote in my piece from Robert Thompson, the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, who says that, sort of disparagingly, the New York Times is better than the Chinese Communist Party at committees. And while he's sort of joking there, his point is that, you know, News Corp and the Wall Street Journal are run very much as entrepreneurial ventures. And that's really what defines News Corp. So then to understand what the company is, it is really a collection of businesses that Rupert Murdoch has built and assembled over the last 30 plus years, you know, each different decade he's moved into a different business. So while your listeners may know Fox News as sort of the most sort of active and visible part of his empire, you know, he owns the 20th Century Fox movie studio, which just produced Avatar, the highest grossing movie of all time.
$2 billion.
He owns HarperCollins, a tremendously successful publishing house. It's also a fantastically global company. So News Corp, while its businesses like Fox News are very well known here in the States, they also have significant stakes in B Sky B, which is the premier British paid television service. They have paid television services in Italy, in Germany, TV stations and channels in Asia. So it's a global company that represents sort of the global international reach and vision of Rupert. And it's just a fascinating company to write about because, again, it's not a lot of bureaucracies. They don't make decisions, sort of boring, watered down corporate decisions like many other firms do. They really sort of make these instinctual gut decisions that stem from Rupert's vision.
And, of course, also big newspapers in Australia, his original home in the UK, The Sun, The Times, television stations all over through Fox, all over the United States, New York, L.A., Chicago, you know, Boston, Dallas, Detroit, you name it, lots and lots. And, of course, papers right there in your hometown, the New York Post, and headquartered there, the Wall Street Journal. And out of all this empire, the weapon that Rupert Murdoch is now kind of aiming at the New York Times is the Wall Street Journal. What's the vision?
Well, the vision, as you stated at the beginning of the program here, it's exactly as you framed it. It's remarkable. He wants to transform the Wall Street Journal from a financial publication and transform it into a broad-based general interest newspaper that will really challenge the New York Times to be the country's preeminent agenda setter. And, you know, Rupert gave a speech yesterday to the Real Estate Board of New York. It was sort of an industry luncheon, and he was the keynote speaker. And it was the first time that he publicly acknowledged his efforts to launch a metropolitan news section inside the Wall Street Journal in New York. And you really can't underestimate the significance of that, because here is Rupert Murdoch owning the Wall Street Journal and starting a local news section in New York City in the New York Times' home turf. And that, to me, really embodies this fact that the Wall Street Journal now is a newspaper and not just a business paper. And he hopes to, you know, lure in affluent sort of elite readers that historically might have read The Times. And he says, listen, I'm going to give you everything you want in one paper. And he's hoping that he can define the way news is set in America.
So he's going after the New York Times not only in its national stature as a kind of a the most powerful kind of top of the pops when it comes to newspapers in this country, but it's going after it on its home turf with a local edition. Who would have thought that would ever exist a couple of years ago? A local New York edition of the Wall Street Journal, or a section. When does that come out? What's it going to look like?
Well, it's going to launch sometime in April. They've been in the sort of secretive planning phases, and my piece was the first time that anyone from the journal had acknowledged it publicly. Robert Thompson talked about how it was the latest transformation of the journal, but it's been several other news outlets have reported on it in recent months. It's been sort of in secret planning now. And, you know, they're really trying to appeal to, you know, elite readers in New York. They're going to cover politics. They're going to cover Albany state politics. They're going to cover the educational system. And, you know, it's remarkable because the Wall Street Journal historically had been edited for business readers. And, you know, the longtime editor of the paper, Paul Steiger, used to tell staff members of the journal that the paper was a second read. And what he meant by that was not a second read in terms of being lesser than another newspaper, but the way the paper was edited was that its front page would have long investigative articles about business, and people who are interested in general news would often subscribe to to another newspaper. So you would get your New York Times for your international or national news, and then you would subscribe to the Wall Street Journal for your financial news. And what Rupert Murdoch believes strongly is that in this very competitive media landscape, no one has time for two newspapers anymore. You know, so you have to offer the kind of reader that you want, everything under one roof. And so what he hopes is he can crowd out the New York Times by keeping his business readers and then offering general interest readers enough general news so that they'll drop their New York Times subscription.
If he succeeds, well, we'll look at what Murdoch stands for, what the New York Times stands for, has stood for. But give us a sense of the vulnerability of the New York Times right now. I mean, they've had staff cuts and page reductions. They've had to remortgage their brand new headquarters there in Manhattan. They've had to put ads on page one. We've never seen that before. And I'm looking here at a story from Bloomberg News just out this week saying, you know, the New York Times shares are up, stock is up, but because there are a lot of rumors that it could be bought, sold.
Well, there's no doubt that the last several years have been extremely challenging for the New York Times on the financial front. You know, the paper, like all media organizations, has been battered by a decline of advertising and circulation. And as media migrates to the web, the business model has yet to sort of work itself out. And, you know, that's a whole sort of separate conversation that we could talk about, how the Times is trying to, you know, navigate transforming itself into a interactive media company. They're about to, at the end of this year, going to unveil their own version of a paid website. So that, you know, they're trying to work through that. But there is no doubt that the paper has been extremely challenged financially. And that is a vulnerability for them because News Corp, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, has tremendous financial resources that he has shown that he is willing to bear on its on his newspaper properties. You know, if you look at the New York Post, Rupert has lost upwards of $50 to $70 million a year to finance the New York Post because he believes so strongly in what the New York Post means for his company and his agenda in New York City.
And he can do that, though, there and in many places because of his super, super cash cow, which is Fox News.
Which is Fox News, and it's the movie studio, and it's the paid television services. Yes, he has these other assets that can basically underwrite some of his slower performing newspaper assets. And if you look at the Wall Street Journal, we're seeing that pattern play itself out again. You know, last year my sources told me that the paper lost between $80 and $100 million. And if Rupert is really willing to underwrite and finance the Journal at a loss for years to come, I've raised this question with the people I interviewed for this story. It really raises the question how the New York Times can compete with a competitor who's willing to make irrational economic decisions, because you often think that in business, each competitor makes decisions in their self-interest and the best player will win. Well, here we have one competitor who's willing to say, I'm going to lose millions of dollars just because I believe in this from a sort of philosophical standpoint. And so I'm going to be fascinated to see how the New York Times, you know, in the medium to long run, can compete with News Corp if Rupert is willing to sustain losses like he has been.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Rupert Murdoch, master of Fox News and much more, going after the New York Times. And who, if anyone, will set the news agenda of the nation? Gabriel Sherman is with us from New York Magazine. Murdoch's Endgame is the big headline on the magazine there, and he's gone deep on Rupert Murdoch going after Google, trying to think about succession in News Corp, which he has run for such a long time, and going after the New York Times, trying to topple it, make his own properties, maybe through the offices of the Wall Street Journal, the agenda setter in this country. Here we've got from a comment from the website, Gabe. This is from Jim. He says, if the New York Times keeps providing facts and Fox News keeps providing political incendiary opinions, then it's quite sad to say the Times might eventually lose. But he goes on to say, most Americans prefer hardcore and fictional opinions over facts. Facts equate to liberalism, which America cannot accept. What do you make of Jim's analysis there, Gabe?
Well, I think that's a pretty widely held view amongst a certain
set.
But I think it's important. It's a very important distinction to point out that, you know, in the 2 years that Rupert has controlled the Wall Street Journal, News Corp has not influenced a sort of a political ideology. At the paper. The paper's sensibility and the tone has definitely changed, and we can talk about how the Wall Street Journal has changed under Rupert Murdoch. But it's too simplistic and narrow to look at the way he's changed it and assume that he's infusing the paper with a sort of a conservative agenda. You know, the Wall Street Journal historically has had a very conservative editorial page, and that has not changed, obviously. But the news coverage of the paper has not adopted this sort of Fox News brand of politics. And I think, you know, anyone who's reading the paper and drawing those conclusions, I think it's important to understand that while the paper has changed, we have not seen the sort of political interference that many people worried might have happened when he bought the paper.
But look at and beyond the Wall Street Journal for a moment at News Corp. I mean, if there's a battle that matters here, if this isn't just a battle of egos, if there's a battle that matters about philosophy, about perspective on the world, about understanding of journalism, if there's a battle that matters, what are the sides? If Murdoch's on one side and the Times on the other, how would you describe the confrontation here? What is it?
Well, what really, Tom, this is a sort of two fundamental worldviews. And I'll start with the Wall Street Journal because I spent a lot of time talking to editors and reporters there. And the way Rupert Murdoch and his handpicked editor, Robert Thompson, view journalism is that American journalism, in their view, is often written by journalists for journalists. You know, we have this cult of journalism prizes in America, they believe. They believe prizes like the Pulitzer Prize and other awards encourage a sort of decadent style of journalism that often isn't what readers want. And Rupert Murdoch has had a
decadent
long history.
Dogged.
Well, in their view, it's not that they think it's – yes, it's dogged, but they feel that it's a lot of kind of pulling at the heartstrings style stories that often don't really get to the heart of what readers want to know about what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so what Rupert believes is that, you know, journalism should be much more to the point. It should be much more direct. The articles should be shorter. They should be snappier. Newspapers should jump at you at the newsstands. The headlines should grab you when you walk by and make you do nothing else but stop and pick up the paper. And that's sort of his worldview. Now the New York Times on their side, and I would also include the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times and sort of the traditional American journalism establishment, their view is that they really serve a social function, that they are, especially the Times, a sort of an archive of American values and culture, and the paper really serves a key role in the functioning of our democracy.
Isn't that the notion in the Constitution, the free press and its importance? Or just to be snappy, I don't want to reduce Murdoch's view to just snappiness, but the Times didn't invent that idea, did it?
They did not invent that idea, but I think Rupert does not ascribe to a vision of journalism that holds itself in the same sort of self-importance and sense of mission that the Times does. Now we could sort of discuss whether one point of view is better than the other, but I wanted to just sort of lay out the two spheres of where both of them are operating, and I think that's a key distinction because Rupert looks at Arthur Sulzberger, who is the owner and chairman of the New York Times. And he senses a man who believes in his own importance, and Rupert has always felt that he is never sort of drunk the Kool-Aid. You know, he's never wanted to be in the club, in the establishment, and he sees someone like Arthur Sulzberger as this embodiment of the establishment entrenched power that needs to be shaken up. And it's his job, it's Rupert Murdoch's job as an outsider, as someone outside the club, to sort of to shake up and rewrite the rules of the game.
Murdoch has done a lot of things on a kind of grudge basis, but there's, you report, personal pique involved here too. When the Wall Street Journal was up for sale, Rupert Murdoch felt insulted by the Times' response.
Exactly, and it follows a pattern. You know, to understand first of all, to understand the way Rupert Murdoch views the world, you have to back up to the earlier part of his career. You know, he's an Australian. His whole empire was built on the foundation of owning one newspaper in Australia, the Adelaide News, years and years ago. And when he decided to branch out and expand the company, he moved to London. And when he moved to London in the 1960s and 70s. You know, he was, as an Australian, considered a complete outsider, as sort of cloistered and elite as New York society is. You know, London even has much more entrenched class distinctions. And Rupert sort of developed this sense of class antagonism, which had defined his worldview. And he sort of appropriated for himself this outsider, almost pirate-like notion. You know, the people at News Corp and around the company refer to themselves as pirates, sort of marauding and raiding the entrenched powers. And that has defined the way he's seen himself and looked at the world. So, you know, fast forward now, he is at the top of his powers, the height of business success. You know, politicians, celebrities, people in tremendous positions of power are all around him. And yet he does not really seek out their attentions, doesn't care what they think of him. And so he looks at a man like Arthur Sulzberger, who he sees as self-important and arrogant and sort of entitled. And there really is a sense of, I want to beat him because I feel that there's a sense of arrogance and And I think that that's really what's fascinating is that there, at the heart of the, this competition is really just a sort of a lot of personal animus amongst both men, and that's you know ultimately you know business. I like to think of as really just human stories, and it really this is a human drama.
Let me nail you down as much as I can here. What would toppling the Times mean? What would beating the Times mean? I mean, when would Murdoch have won here? Does it mean the Times going out of business? Does it mean the Wall Street Journal, you know, just crushing it on circulation in New York, nationally? How would he define sad parallel? Well, how would he define victory?
Well, in a funny way, you talk to people at the Wall Street Journal, and they try to impress upon me the point that in a way they're already winning because circulation at the Wall Street Journal actually rose. In the last reported period, and when newspaper circulation across the country was falling, but you know more broadly on a kind of a macro level, I think what they would define as winning as the New York Times continuing to shrink to its kind of core sort of readership, Upper West, you know, as the people of the Journal like to, you know, snipe, you know, the sort of Upper West Side New York liberal readership. And while the Wall Street Journal would continue to grow and become the country's biggest, it already is the biggest by circulation, but just continue to grow to be the sort of unchallenged biggest newspaper of record, where it sets the agenda in Washington, it sets the agenda in business, and now that they're expanding their cultural coverage, it's setting the agenda with arts and culture, and just sort of defining the way mainstream the news agenda is established.
I wonder. Gabe Sherman, please stand by in New York with New York Magazine. We're going to hear in just a moment from Alan Mutter in San Francisco. I want to get a couple of calls in first, if I may, from New York City. Dylan is calling. Dylan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I do live in New York, and the New York Post isn't a national paper, and within New York, it's rather considered to be a bit of a tabloid.
This is Murdoch's paper in New York right now, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's kind of a vulgar celebrity gossip opinion journalism paper. While they do absolutely do, you know, they run good pieces occasionally, but I'm interested as to what will happen to, what the impact will be on the financial sector if the Wall Street Journal goes that route, as it sounds like he's kind of thinning out the paper. He wants to include more. He wants to start with a local section and things like that. What will happen to the financial sector when it is a national paper that goes the direction of the Post?
Gabe Sherman?
Well, that's a good question, and I think the important question is not to look at whether Rupert Murdoch is going to turn the Wall Street Journal into a tabloid, because I don't think there's any evidence of that. But I think that Dylan raises a great point that I think for the core Wall Street readership who read the paper for really hardcore business coverage, I think there is a concern among some people I talked to that, you know, by adding all this extra news, politics, foreign affairs, culture, now local news, the worry is that the paper is going to water down its financial coverage. And maybe this will present an opportunity for the Financial Times, or maybe this will present an opportunity for Bloomberg News, which has been on a hiring spree. And it's funny to note that a lot of the Wall Street Journal former staff members who were sort of pushed out in the Murdoch takeover have all landed on their feet at Bloomberg News. And so, you know, we could see a reorientation of the financial business news landscape, and that other players will sort of take over as Rupert broadens out the paper. Maybe it will present opportunities for other. But I do think that's a great point that, you know, the Wall Street Journal's core franchise, which was business coverage, you know, there is an open question that adding all this extra stuff, you know, you really wonder, are they taking their eye off of their core mission, which was to cover the financial sector?
Dylan, thanks for your call. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
2 points. I think Fox News already controls the political debate in this country. The Republicans want to get on Fox to make their points, and the Democrats, all they do is react to Fox's browbeating, and it's been that way ever since Bush was coming to power back in 2000. Hmm. Second point, the Nazis teamed up with a media mogul in pre-World War II Germany called Alfred Hugenberg, and he was sort of the same thing as Murdoch, buying up a lot of media and really supporting right-wing causes, meaning the Nazis back in the day. And I think that's what Murdoch is after, is controlling the politics in this country.
And you think he's well on his way with Fox News?
He's well on his way. He may be, you know, maybe it didn't work out with Bush, but he's looking for another somebody on the same Republican leader that he can pump up and control.
John, thanks for your call. Giva, I'm going to let you just sit and think about that one for a minute. I don't know about Nazis, but I would say Fox News certainly has a whole lot of sway already. John, thanks for your call. Let's go to San Francisco and Alan Mutter. His blog is Reflections of a Newsosaur, comments on technology and media. Worked a lot in newspapers in Chicago and San Francisco. He teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, a course called Journalism in an Age of Disruption. No kidding. Alan Mutter, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
What do you make of this? Is this the last of the dinosaurs at war? Does it matter if it's Murdoch or the New York Times on top? Do you see that kind of struggle going on, Alan?
Yes, I do believe it's the last big newspaper war that we'll be treated to in our lifetime. The newspaper business is shrinking owing to changes in advertiser and consumer behavior. And so there are very few places in this country anymore that even have more than one newspaper. In fact, we're about one of the two last two newspaper towns outside of the East is in Honolulu, where one of the papers that probably will close within a matter of months. So, yes, there won't be very many more newspaper wars because we won't see multiple newspapers in the markets.
So can one of these titans win? And if they win, what does that mean? Or has the complexion of American journalism already changed with
I think you just asked the most interesting question. What does win mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because there, you know, the reality is that the audience for print products is shrinking. And in fact, the costs of being a print publisher at some point are going to outstrip the benefits of being a print publisher. And by that, I mean younger people want to get their news on mobile phones or on the web. They do not tend to be oriented to print. Half of the newspapers in this country are sold to people 50 years and older, and that's disproportionate to their share in the population. What that means is that at some point, owning a newspaper in the modern world of interactive communications, owning a newspaper may be a disadvantage, not an advantage. So plowing money into creating new newspaper infrastructure, building new presses, creating new newsroom in New York, such as the Journal is doing, these are all things that are actually going the wrong way when you think about the long horizon of history here and what's about to happen in the world of journalism.
If these are really dead men walking, maybe it doesn't matter. But of course, both these entities really want to be reborn in the digital realm, if they are. And doesn't it matter whose spirit kind of animates that realm, Alan? Or
well, yes. You asked a couple questions at the same time,
mm-hmm.
So let me answer. Let me say that it certainly matters who has the biggest pulpit here in the future, and you're right about that. But I think that you don't necessarily have to own a newspaper to do it. And I also believe that even the biggest speakers in the future in the interactive world will not be as big as the big speakers used to be in the pre-interactive era. There are just too many voices. There are too many ways for too many people to enter the conversation globally around the world, around the clock, that even a Fox News, as big as it is compared to the other cable networks, it still just has a fraction of the audience of even the CBS Evening News, which is the worst, has the worst possible ratings of the big three networks. Let me just say that Fox News has an audience that's larger than Headline News, CNN, and MSNBC combined on the ordinary day. But even at that, it's about 750,000 people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Rupert Murdoch and his News Corp empire, Wall Street Journal, Fox News, and all the rest. Going after, says my guest today, Gabe Sherman, the New York Times, and what it matters, what it means, who wins there. Gabriel Sherman joins us from New York, contributing editor at New York Magazine. His big cover story this week is Murdoch's Endgame. Alan Mutter, big media thinker, joins us from San Francisco. His blog is Reflections of a Newsosaur. Let's get a call from Miranda, Augusta, Georgia. Miranda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are y'all?
Pretty well. What do you see, Miranda?
I think it's a good thing that Rupert Murdoch is doing this. The best thing, I think, could happen to journalism. I think the quality of the New York Times journalism has been going down for about 10 years, and there's nothing like a little new blood and competition to just improve the quality overall.
So bring it on, you say. Thanks for your call. Gabe Sherman, what about it?
Well, I think there is something to that. I think competition's always good for the marketplace. As a reporter myself, I think it's encouraging that Rupert Murdoch is willing to invest lots of money in this business. I think it's fundamentally good for the Times in a certain respect that they're being challenged to commit resources and to really look at everything they're doing and making sure it's, you know, the best possible way to maximize their journalism. So sure, I mean, in certain regards, it is great for the news industry and newspapers that there is new capital being invested. Now, and I think Alan raised a lot of good points on, you know, whether this is, you know, sort of all this attention being paid to short-term gain, given the sort of long-term macro trends that we're seeing in the news business. But, you know, in the short run, A, it's good for journalism, and B, it's a lot of fun to write about.
Some will agree, some won't. I want to come to you, Alan, on that. Let me get one more call first. Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah. I just got done hearing one of your callers mentioning the New York Times and Rupert Murdoch and the word quality all in the same sentence. Oh, my God. First of all, the New York Times is probably the best in journalism you're ever going to get. I'm not saying that it's always right. It doesn't say it's always right. But there's no question but that it pursues the truth and facts and figures every way and any way it possibly can. It bends over backwards. And when it's wrong, it points out the fact that it's wrong. The other factor that I'd like to bring out, one of your commentators there brought out the word agenda. And I think that's a very important word. Rupert Murdoch has an agenda. And the agenda for Rupert Murdoch is, in and of itself, not truth. Rupert Murdoch wants to see a philosophy triumph, period. The New York Times wants to see that it gets the truth all the time, as much as it possibly can. And the other factor I'd like to bring up is nothing, I don't care what happens in the electronic media, nothing is ever going to replace the newspaper. I will be very sorry to see it go. There's something about holding it that makes you perceive it in greater depth.
Bill, big points all. Let us go to them. Alan Mutter, how about it? Miranda says competition is good. She's happy for, you know, Murdoch shoving in here. Bill says it's truth versus philosophy when you look at agenda.
Competition is great, and it makes all of us better. It makes everybody work harder, whether we're talking about cars or journalism or tacos. So, yeah, we're all for that. I'm not so sure that Rupert Murdoch has an agenda other than that everybody be looking at him and listening to what he has to say. I think over history, he's proven to be extremely agile with respect to what he believes in. What he is inclined to do is position his media properties according to certain market segments that he has identified as being lucrative. For example, he publishes The Times in the UK, which is as staid and boring as gray and serious a newspaper as is the New York Times here in the United States. On the other hand, he does love publishing those gritty tabloid type newspapers that we know in the New York Post here, mm-hmm. and he has a number around the world. He also publishes the most important and respected newspapers in Australia, as well as some of the sleaziest ones. And the reality is that Murdoch has built a series, as Gabe said, a series of media properties, many of which are quite lucrative, and they actually support his hobby of running other properties that he just wants to run because he wants people to notice him. He's bought the New York Post so he could be noticed, not to make money. Most people in business don't do things like that. So from a business point of view, there's not a lot of sense for him spending all this money to go to compete with the New York Times to be an upper crust newspaper in New York when most of the upper crust readers already take the Wall Street Journal. It's not a business thing. It's an ego thing.
Gabe, how do you see it? Just ego? I mean, when it comes to agenda, is it just as ego? Is it simple as that? Our caller says it's truth versus philosophy, or maybe if Alan's right, truth versus profit. How do you see the agendas at play here?
I think Alan raised a lot of good points. I think it is too simplistic and sort of binary to look at Rupert strictly through a right-left political prism. You know, I think he has as Alan points out, a very agile sort of opportunistic view of politics. You know, I think you can't discount the fact that several years ago, he reached out to Hillary Clinton, who's sort of the embodiment of everything Fox News has come to attack. You know, recently Rupert Murdoch's News Corp gave money to Andrew Cuomo, who in all likelihood will run for governor of New York as a Democrat. So, you know, in terms of the agenda, yes, Rupert believes in sort of limited government, free markets. But I think the agenda ultimately is whatever will make him a more successful business person and a more powerful media mogul, which is, and I think he defines power by how much he is at the center of the sort of the debate about media and politics and business, and going to that white hot center is where he wants to be. So to do that, he sometimes has to go to the right. But he also, you know, in the UK, the London tabloid The Sun was very much the paper that created Tony Blair and New Labour. So, you know, he has decided in whatever markets he's playing in what will maximize his power.
But
in terms of the New York Times, let me just make one point about the Times and agenda. I think what drives Rupert Murdoch and News Corp nuts about the Times is that the Times cloaks itself in this sense of social mission. And what Rupert believes is that the Times is very much the vehicle to channel the Sulzberger family's interests, which is sort of establishment center-left politics. And yet there's this double standard where they believe they're chasing truth, and Rupert believes that they're chasing their own interests. And Rupert believes that publishers should have agendas and should have interests, and you shouldn't hide it, but you should acknowledge that it exists. And that's what he, I think, believes that New York Times, fails to do.
Alan Mutter, in terms of agendas, though, there seems to be a pretty big chasm. Gabe described earlier, he said the Times believes in a social function for journalism. Rupert is about entertainment, success, power. Isn't that a pretty big divide?
Oh, I think they would both stake claims to, and rightfully so, to both sides of that continuum. I don't think it's an either and or. The New York Times has been able, up until the newspaper business sort of fell off the cliff a few years ago, the New York Times spent a great amount of its resources in creating lifestyle sections. At one point they had hired a fragrance correspondent who covered the perfume industry.
Yeah.
So the New York Times has done more, plenty of its entertainment, more circus than bread kind of coverage. And there's nothing wrong with that, because it's really part of, it's reflecting the culture holistically, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I wouldn't say that the New York Times is all serious. It's not just all broccoli. There's plenty of s'mores in the New York Times if you look for them.
Yeah.
But by the same token, I think that the Murdoch, the heavy duty, serious, hard nosed, deep digging journalism that is characteristic of both the Journal and the New York Times, that is the meat and potatoes. Going back to the food analogies here, that is the meat and potatoes of what the national dialogue is all about. They both do it a lot. They both do it very well. They all have their bad days. But on balance, with the both of them working together to do what they're supposed to do, they do, on whole, a pretty good job. And I wouldn't say that there's anything trivial about coverage in the Wall Street Journal.
Let's go to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Philip. Philip, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I take issue with I think the general consensus of the panel that competition is good in the newspaper industry. I'm not so certain of that. I think competition is what has been the cause of dumbing down newspapers, including the fragrance section of the New York Times. Or take a look at the New York Times' headlines, or sports headlines in particular. Everything is the lowest common denominator.
In the New York Times?
Sorry?
In the New York Times is the lowest common denominator in this country? I mean...
No. New York Times is probably the greatest newspaper in the country.
Okay.
But I can see, but I can see evidence of trying to compete with USA Today, trying to compete with newspapers who are trivializing just for market share. So I'm not sure competition is that good or has been that. One of your panelists said competition is good in everything, including tacos. I think the newspaper industry is different from tacos. I think the newspaper industry is sui generis, and competition is not necessarily to the benefit of us newspaper readers.
Philip, we've got it, and we're glad to hear from Minneapolis, and we'll get to it. Let me hold it right there and get Beth in here, if I may. Wakefield, Massachusetts. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi. I grew up in Wakefield, but I've spent most of my adult life in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And Pennsylvania is a place where it's very hard to find clear-cut information. I do have a college degree, but I spent most of my adult life as a caseworker, working over 10 hours a day. And the only way I could really feel that I had access to any decent news was by getting on the Internet and reading the New York Times that was delivered to me. I feel very strongly and fervently that they do a good job with their mission. Where in the economic crisis, I'm one of the few people I know that has even a little bit of a bead on what actually happened, and it's because I closely followed all the articles in the economic section of the New York Times.
And what if they're toppled, whatever that means, by Murdoch's News Corp? What do you think, Beth?
It's not competition. It's monopoly, and we're supposed to have laws against that. I don't understand the full details, but I guess a lot of them were repealed under the previous administration, and that really concerns me. I also belonged to MySpace and was quite active on that politically until Murdoch took over, and then the rules were changed that you couldn't forward anything political. I really think that this man is a detriment to our democracy. I think there are a lot of average people out there like me that are not wired in and are really depending on the New York Times. We tolerate the garbage that they produce for the glitz because we respect the core, the diamond, the core of the New York Times, which is the truth. And it scares me. I don't know enough about the man Murdoch to know if he has any respect for the truth, but I know that the New York Times does, and I want to see it prevail. And I would like to see make sure that any anti-monopoly laws that can be applied are in this case.
Beth, we got it. The New York Times, which is the truth. That's a pretty absolute statement there, but we hear it loud and clear. Let me get Orlando, Florida in. We'll come back to our panel. Kevin. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi. I read a lot, and do you think that the Times' biggest problem, just so old and stodgy and maybe a little bit uppity compared to the other news sources that we have, and we've stripped off the layer of the onion to the point that these traditional newspapers, not just them, the Post, too, have lost their, mojo, whatever you want to call it, and that's why they're just not profitable. People
and do you mean compared to other news sources like sources on the web, Kevin?
Yes, because I spend a lot of time reading, and I always bounce what I read at one site against other sites. Because people do write bias one way or the other, and I kind of think that's the Times' biggest problem is they haven't kept up with this change that we can take advantage of it. We can compare to what the Times says, to what the LA Times, the Post, the New York Times, London Times.
Yeah.
And when you write, you have to be very careful to make sure it is correct because the readership obviously has drifted away. I think a big part is they don't see the Times as the cutting edge anymore.
Well, you may have me on stodginess. I'm not sure on accuracy if you're necessarily going to better it on the web, but maybe, Gabe, Alan, we got a lot on the table here. A caller who says, newspapers aren't tacos. He's not so sure about competition. Beth, who says, Alan, that the New York Times is the truth. And then our stodginess complaint, Kevin's in Orlando, is ready to go online. What do you hear in all that, Alan?
Well, first I have to say that competition in newspapers and tacos is a good thing. I've been involved with the newspaper industry for quite a number of years, and I can tell you that when newspapers are competing, they work harder, they put more resources into things, and the reader gets a better product. And more importantly, people have choices in what they can hear or read or see when you have multiple media.
Even when resources are evaporating, Alan, even then?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I'm sorry, but even when resources are evaporating, the new reality here?
Well, I think when resources are evaporating, we're going to get less. There's going to be less meat in the taco. or less tofu, depending on your point of view.
Yeah.
And I think that we all benefit as a society when we hear lots of voices. Some people love the New York Times on this program. Some people don't. That's okay. The point is that they're reading, and the point is that they also have other alternatives. They can look at Fox News. They can look at blogs. They can write a blog. That's what's really changed about the whole media business. As powerful as Murdoch is, and he is, but he is the last, literally the last dinosaur walking the earth. There won't be that many people who have as much power as a Sulzberger family or a Murdoch in the future, because the media will be very much fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And because we have lots of people contributing their voices, we're going to actually have a richer dialogue. The problem in all that is, it's going to be very hard for all of us who care about public affairs to figure out what to believe, where the information is, how to find it, what to believe, and what to disbelieve. And so we're going to have to do a lot more work, but that is the future, and there's no stopping it.
Gabe, we've just got a minute here. Rupert Murdoch turns 79 a week from tomorrow. His son James may be coming on behind. Does the Rupert Murdoch cast last through a change in leadership here? Does it last into the next generation, or would it be a whole new deal?
Well, that fundamentally for my piece is the sort of central tension in the sort of final question I wanted to answer. And I think everything in what Rupert's doing now and everything he's doing, what you see is that he's almost in a race against time. He's in a race to justify and rationalize his empire before that transition happens. Because, you know, once James or whoever, I mean, it's on the succession question is not answered, but whoever does ultimately succeed Rupert, it will be a very different company after that transition takes place. And so that's Rupert's in a race not only against his own clock, but the clock for the people coming up behind him.
A race, and we're all in the bleachers, or maybe even hauled into the race with him. Really, a great piece of reporting. We enjoyed the piece a lot. Gabriel Sherman with New York Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us this hour. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And Alan Mutter in San Francisco with the blog Reflections of a News Czar. Alan Mutter, wonderful to have you with us. Thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.